WATD presents Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi.
If it's Monday night, it's got to be Monday Night Talk with Kevin Tachi. So thanks for having me on.
Kevin, good for you to hold back and let him tell his story.
Putting the South Shore spin on politics, current events, and pop culture.
You guys are the center of the universe today, at least the political universe.
I believe both of you are from the area. Marshall guys, yes, no?
Correct, yeah.
That's right.
There's only one person not from Marshfield in this room right now. And it's you.
It's me. I'm the outcast.
Well, you've always been generous with the time. I appreciate it very much.
Well, I'm honored to be on your show tonight, Kevin, with that impressive lineup you have.
I believe our guest that we've been waiting for, Congressman Stephen Lynch.
Kevin, good to join you.
The governor of the Commonwealth,
very
Charlie
good.
Baker. You ready?
I got to tell you that it was really nice to hear Aerosmith on the intro there.
You're going to be the rock and roll governor?
I don't know about that, but...
We have Mayor Joe Sullivan joining us. Sir, how are you?
Well, Kevin, very good to be with you again.
Dr. Drew Pinsky. Dr. Drew, are you there?
I'm here. Thanks for having me.
Mr. Ming Tsai, welcome to the show, sir.
Hey, thanks, Kevin.
Massachusetts State Auditor Suzanne Bump. Hello, Auditor. How are you?
I am fine, and I'm delighted to be with you this evening.
And now, your host, Kevin Tachi.
Welcome and good evening. You are indeed tuned into Monday Night Talk. My name is Kevin Tachi. Thank you so much for keeping your radio dial set right there. So we have a fantastic lineup of guests who will provide some, hopefully some stimulating conversation. We'll kick things off in a couple of moments after traffic, starting with Brockton City Councilor Shirley Azak. Shirley represents Ward 7 in the City of Champions. She so happens to be throwing her proverbial hat into the ring, hoping that you will elect her. Come, well, first you're going to pick her in September, and then if she moves on in November, it's a good chance that she could become the representative for the 11th Plymouth District, which, because of redistricting, that just the whole state has undergone that. The new redistricting 11th Plymouth District will no longer be a couple of precincts in Easton and a little bit of Brockton, but it'll be all Brockton, not all Brockton like it's the entire city, but that the district will be a good portion of the city of Brockton. We'll chat with Shirley as to why she is a candidate and some of the issues she sees in the race. Right after Shirley, we're going to speak with realtor, businessman, Richard Rosen. Richard is not only a premier sponsor of this radio program, but he's somebody who has been in the real estate business for close to four decades or around four decades. I love having realtors on right around this time of year. So kind of give you some insight into the spring market. Have things changed? Maybe give you some reminders. Maybe you're somebody who is going to be in the market to buy a home. Maybe you're going to put your house on the market. We'll speak with Richard and get some of his wisdom to share with you if you are in thinking about doing something in regards to buying or selling a home. Hour number two, we'll start off with State Representative Josh Cutler. Now, Josh is not joining us to chat about things that are happening in his district or up at the State House. In fact, going to talk with him about his new book, which is called The Boston Gentleman's Mob. A fantastic read if you haven't had a chance to go and grab it. We'll talk with him about the book, why he put it together, and what are some of the details about it. We'll close the show out with a good friend and radio personality and producer, Mike Joshua. Mike from Americanorama. He's also a producer of for Mudhouse Media, best known for Saint Sinners and Serial Killers. That's the one that Casey Sherman and Dave Wedge did. Well, he produces that. We're going to talk with Mike about the passing of Taylor Hawkins, the Foo Fighters drummer. Early indications right now is that it might have been substance related. We'll chat with Mike about not only his passing, but some of the great musicians throughout history that have either have passed because of substance or alcohol or mechanical failure, whatever it was, but we'll talk with him about that and even get a teaser about a show that he's going to be involved with at the Wilbur on April 20th. So that's all coming up in a bit. Just stay tuned.
Hey, it's Geoff. That's what my friends call me, Geoff, 6'1", 190. I grew up on the South Shore and now I live on the South Coast. Trust me, I'm not the person you think I am. I'm just like you. I have two little girls that are the same as yours. My wife and I go to work while they go to school, just like you. We watch reality TV and participate in social media, just like you. Mal keeps the books while I move things, pick things up, and put things down. Our friends are just like us. We all just want to live, work, and play freely. Thank you to the brave men and women who gave their lives. Thank you to the brave men and women who are currently giving their lives. Thank you to the brave civil servants that are serving our country every day. Thank you to the truck drivers and all of the workers that keep this country going. You are my heroes. You are amazing. You keep doing what you're doing, and we'll keep doing what we're doing. As long as we can, forever and ever, until death do us part. Like you, we stand with Ukraine. Like you, we stand for freedom. Our hearts and our prayers go out to all the people around the Ukraine. Godspeed. This message was brought to you by Brennan's Smoke Shop.
This is Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi.
Back for the first segment of Monday Night's Talk. And traditionally, anybody who's listened to the show knows that the State House report is kind of the staple of this radio program. But from time to time, we deviate from that. We'll sometimes do like a county update. Or if we have folks who are running for office, especially if it's state office, well, it's almost like a State House report, but it's more or less we give candidates an opportunity to talk about why they're running for office. So happens joining us is somebody who actually has been on the radio show previously, a couple of times previously, as she is a ward counselor in the city of Brockton, Ward 7 counselor. Shirley Azak is my guest, and she's not here to talk about the city of Brockton necessarily, but more so to talk to us a little bit about her campaign to hopefully be the next 11th Plymouth District state representative, which right now I believe is an open seat because Claire Cronin is now serving in the Irish Embassy. Hello.
Hi, Kevin. How are you?
It's been a while. Now, I think the last time I had you on, counselor, you were chatting with me as the council president for Brockton.
Yes, that was back in 2020, a memorable year. And I, when I, you know, was voted in to be council president, I never imagined the year ahead. I had a lot of hopes and plans, but we were a little detoured by a pandemic. But I think, you know, we worked hard. We kept city business moving, and it was challenging, but it was very interesting.
But I would ask, so for folks who don't know who you are, folks who may be new to the district, because I believe, does the 11th Plymouth District, will it undergo a bit of a redistricting for whoever is elected in for January, start of January?
So the existing district, the 11th Plymouth District, is very different from the district that it will be January 2023. Right now, which is Claire Cronin, Ambassador Cronin, represented the 11th Plymouth District. Very happy, excited for her. She that's absolutely amazing. And so we are so proud of her. But right now, the 11th Plymouth consists of Easton and parts Ward 1 in Brockton and part of Ward 7. As of next year, it's going to look very different. It's going to be all Brockton, so there will be no outside towns in this district. It's all Brockton. It's all of Ward 7, which is where the ward that I represent as a city councilor. It's one precinct in Ward 1, all of Ward 2, which is the center of Brockton, and two precincts in Ward 3. So it's an all Brockton seat. So it's going to look very different.
So it's almost as though if you are successful first during the primary in September and then are successful in November, it's almost as though you are becoming a mini at-large counselor. But you're a state representative. Is that kind of a unique description?
It's very different. So I know a lot of, you know, Brockton has, we have 11 city councilors, 7 wards, and then 4 at large that represent the city. But technically, we all represent the whole city. When we are voting, we're very rarely voting on just a specific area in the city. Where it becomes interesting to be a ward counselor is to deal.
Welcome and good evening. You are indeed tuned into Monday Night Talk. My name is Kevin Tocci. Thank you so much for keeping your radio dial set right there. So we have a fantastic lineup of guests who will provide some, hopefully some stimulating conversation. We'll kick things off in a couple of moments after traffic, starting with Brockton City Councilor Shirley Azak. Shirley represents Ward 7 in the City of Champions. She so happens to be throwing her proverbial hat into the ring, hoping that you will elect her. Come, well, first you're going to pick her in September, and then if she moves on in November, it's a good chance that she could become the representative for the 11th Plymouth District, which, because of redistricting, that just the whole state has undergone that. The new redistricting 11th Plymouth District will no longer be a couple of precincts in Easton and a little bit of Brockton, but it'll be all Brockton, not all Brockton like it's the entire city, but that the district will be a good portion of the city of Brockton. We'll chat with Shirley as to why she is a candidate and some of the issues she sees in the race. Right after Shirley, we're going to speak with realtor, businessman, Richard Rosen. Richard is not only a premier sponsor of this radio program. We are back for the first segment of Monday Night's Talk. And traditionally, anybody who's listened to the show knows that the State House report is kind of the staple of this radio program. But from time to time, we deviate from that. We'll sometimes do like a county update. Or if we have folks who are running for office, especially at state office, well, it's almost like a State House report, but it's more or less we give candidates an opportunity to talk about why they're running for office. So happens joining us is somebody who actually has been on the radio show previously, a couple of times previously, as she is a ward counselor in the city of Brockton, Ward 7 counselor. Shirley Azak is my guest, and she's not here to talk about the city of Brockton necessarily, but more so to talk to us a little bit about her campaign to hopefully be the next 11th Plymouth District state representative, which right now I believe is an open seat because Claire Cronin is now serving in the Irish Embassy. Hello.
Hi, Kevin. How are you?
It's been a while. Now, I think the last time I had you on, Counselor, you were chatting with me as the council president for Brockton.
Yes, that was back in 2020, a memorable year. And I, when I, you know, was voted in to be council president, I never imagined the year ahead. I had a lot of hopes and plans, but we were a little detoured by a pandemic. But I think, you know, we worked hard. We kept city business moving, and it was challenging, but it was very interesting.
I would ask, so for folks who don't know who you are, folks who may be new to the district, because I believe, does the 11th Plymouth District, will it undergo a bit of a redistricting for whoever is elected in for January, start of January?
So the existing district, the 11th Plymouth District, is very different from the district that it will be January 2023. Right now, which is Claire Cronin, Ambassador Cronin, represented the 11th Plymouth District. Very happy, excited for her. That's absolutely amazing. And so we are so proud of her. But right now, the 11th Plymouth consists of Easton and parts Ward 1 in Brockton and part of Ward 7. As of next year, it's going to look very different. It's going to be all Brockton, so there will be no outside towns in this district. It's all Brockton. It's all of Ward 7, which is where the ward that I represent as a city councilor. It's one precinct in Ward 1, all of Ward 2, which is the center of Brockton, and two precincts in Ward 3. So it's an all Brockton seat. So it's going to look very different.
So it's almost as though you're going to be, well, you're going to be certain if you are successful first during the primary in September and then are successful in November, it's almost as though you are becoming a mini at-large counselor, but you're a state representative. Is that kind of a unique description?
It's very different. So I know a lot of, Brockton has, we have 11 city councilors, 7 wards, and then 4 at-large that represent the city. But technically, we all represent the whole city. When we are voting, we're very rarely voting on just a specific area in the city. Where it becomes interesting to be a ward counselor is to deal with constituent services. So when, usually if somebody's calling in my area, you do want them to speak to a specific ward counselor. So being a at-large counselor and a state rep, I think, are very different because you're dealing with, with the councils, you're dealing with city issues and a city budget. You're dealing with, constituents in this specific area. But at a state level, you're dealing with a much larger budget. We are dealing with, with things that are with the state, whereas it's a lot, it's on a much larger level. It's and that's why I'm interested in this. That's why I've put my all into it, because I truly believe Brockton deserves really good representation at the state level. We're a city, we're the largest, we're the 7th largest city in Massachusetts and the only city in Plymouth County. So we don't always get our fair share of what is due to us, I believe. So I put my all into this to really serve Brockton.
Did it take a lot of consideration for you to say, I'm running for state rep? Or was it kind of one of those things you're like, this has my name written all over it, and I think I think this is something that I should, go after?
So, no, it definitely took consideration because, as you know, I did run in the past for the 9th Plymouth District. So this is something that's always been in the back of my mind. I've always felt that we really need representation at the state level from our municipal leaders that really understand what the city needs, that understand the district. I've lived in this district for over 20 years. So I know what it is. I know the streets, I know the residents, I know the businesses, and I know what the city needs to flourish and to continue growing. So there was a lot of thought put into it. I did receive a few calls from, very people that felt that this was the right thing for me to when the redistricting happened. But I was going through the city election and wanted to get through that first and before I made any announcements. And of course, with all due respect, it was still Claire Cronin's, Ambassador Cronin's seat until she resigned. So that's why we didn't really announce anything until after she announced her resignation and she was sworn in as ambassador. So, but no, this has been on our mind. A lot of people that know me know that this is something that I've worked towards, that I would like, be able to serve my community at the state level.
What you mentioned just moments ago that the city of Brockton doesn't necessarily get all that it needs. What is your understanding, knowing that you're somebody who has served on the city council for many years and that you have an understanding of what it is exactly that the city needs? What are some of the things that you would target and that you would work to get on behalf of the city, and also work with the legislative delegation that would be also working on the Brockton's behalf?
So before I answer that, our legislative delegation, it's very important that the delegation works together because you're strong in numbers, and that's what I'm hoping to do, is work together with them, as one person alone really can't whether it's at the city council or at the state level or federal level, one person alone really can't get things really done. But what I feel like Brockton constantly, you know, being a large city and being the only one in Plymouth County doesn't always, whether it's funding for education. I mean, I know a few years ago, I went up to the State House with my, at the time, high school age daughters and with our superintendent and, you know, group of students and some of my colleagues, really to rally and to support, you know, funding for schools because there was a lot of programs that were going to be cut. So there's a lot of times being such a large district, school district. I mean, we're one of the largest school districts and a lot of our programs sometimes don't get the support they need. So we needed to go up to the State House, fight for the fight for continued funding. Education is always at the top of our list, but also, you know, whether it's money for infrastructure or money in the, you know, I can just use some of the examples that some of our state representatives brought in funds for our parks. I know Ambassador Cronin, right before she was named ambassador, she brought in funds to repave the Brockton High School's parking lot, which is huge, but had that repaved because it was in dire need of it, which, I mean, it was a lot of money. So there's a lot of money that can be advocated for the city of Brockton, and I just hope that I can continue to do that and keep it at, you know, that's my number one priority, is keep funding coming into the city and the maximum amount of funding that Brockton can get because of the type of city we are.
So besides like Chapter 70 money for education and making sure, because you're right, for many years, the city of Brockton struggled with its budget. And we know that under past administrations, that it was always a matter of, oh, we may not have enough money for educational needs. And we're going to have to cut programs. I know that has taken a turn for the better over the past couple of years. I'm sure you could always get more. What about other items like water? I know water was always a main issue for the city of Brockton. Clean water, being able to get enough Chapter 90 money to be able to pave roads. I know that's a big thing with the city and city councilors. And if you ask anybody who has a road that hasn't been done for 20 or 30 years, it's a big deal to them.
That's very true. So, funding Chapter 90 funding for repaving us, we get a limited number of money to repave our streets. If we're lucky, if a counselor's lucky, they'll get a street paid, one street per ward per year, if we're lucky. But I know in past years, it was very difficult. So we have, working together with DPW Commissioner Rowley at the time, we implemented a user fee and the rates to kind of help bring in some money to be used to go specifically towards towards our infrastructure. So that has been in the works in the last year or two. It really, I know it wasn't the best time that we implemented it. We even delayed it because of COVID. It was supposed to be implemented at the beginning of 2020, but we delayed it until the fall of 2020. But that has brought in some funds. And I know we're getting infrastructure money from the federal government. There's I know Senator Markey had made an announcement and Senator Warren made an announcement that there's money that is being given for infrastructure strictly. So, yes, our streets are bad. I'll be honest. I always pride myself that I've had the most streets repaved. Councilor Lally might argue with me, but I have. We've done really well. At the beginning, when I was first elected about 9 years ago, I drove every street in the ward, and we made a 5-year plan with the DPW commissioner, and I've started a new one. So last few years, which worked out really well, because there are some streets that are a lot worse than others. So we can definitely use more money for Chapter 90 money, and being the type of city, you know, that we are. But hopefully there's money coming in from the federal government. And as far as the water, Brockton doesn't lack water. We, as you know, we were required by the state to have a secondary source, which is Aquaria. And that there's been a constant discussion about purchasing Aquaria, which I was in support of way maybe seven years ago. We should have, I remember the late Mayor Carpenter was in support of purchasing it. And I'm a big believer that we should have purchased it because we're required to have a secondary source. So after the contract's done, if we don't have a secondary source, then we're still going to have Aquaria. So, but Aquaria is a whole subject. You know, we can talk for hours about Aquaria.
Okay. As we have a couple of minutes left here, again, we're speaking with Brockton Ward 7 Councillor Shirley Azak, who is a candidate for state representative in the 11th Plymouth District, the newly redistrict as of January 2023. We have a couple of minutes left here. Probably the second to last question that I would ask you is, you know, being a ward counselor, you understand constituent services. You understand, you know, when you get a call from somebody in your ward. Help me equate that from how you'll transition that from being constituent services within a ward to being somebody who is serving your district and giving good constituent services.
So they're very similar. Constituent services at the city council level and constituent services at the state level are very similar. And many times both State Representative Cronin and Cassidy, who both serve parts of Ward 7, I have been out there with them, worked with them on issues that I can't necessarily find an answer at the city level. So I have had to reach out to them. A lot of times it's with elderly housing, or it's with you know, something that's state related, or a large, you know, whether it's or heat, oil, or finding out programs that can help them at the state level. So they go together. I'm hoping that the only difference is that at the state level, you have a lot more resources than I do as a city councilor. Unfortunately, Brockton City Council is, we don't have a staff. We don't have an office. We don't really have, you know, it's pretty much us. So I'm hoping to be able to do more for my constituents if I am elected as a state representative, because I'll have more resources to be able to work with to help them.
This is an opportunity. This is kind of like an open question where basically you can pick your own question. And that is there anything that we haven't talked about in the short amount of time that we've been here chatting in regards to your run? But you want to make sure that you at least address it to the folks who are tuned in listening to you as a candidate for state representative.
I mean, a lot of times, you know, I'll get asked, I've been asked a number of questions of why, you know, why do you want to do this? And I have really grown a passion for public service. I believe that, you know, I work hard for my community, and this is a community that I absolutely love. I've lived all over the world, and, but Brockton was always home, and you know, I feel I can do a great job. I've dedicated my time, as you know, my daughters are older, they're in college. And my I'm a small business owner, so I know the aspect of small business. My business, though, with COVID, I kind of slowed down a lot. So I have the time to put into this. I have the time to put into the district, the time to put into the community. And I also have the passion, the drive, and definitely the experience. 9 years on the city council taught me how to, you know, how government works. You can have any kind of background, but municipal government is, it's its own special, you know, nobody goes in knowing the job. You learn as you go. And I feel that makes me a really great candidate. And I'm looking to represent the community as a whole, not just a specific special interest group, but to represent everyone. And I think that's what Brockton residents deserve.
Yeah. And you know, again, and it's not unheard of that folks are making their way from the city council to the state house. And you have two in the legislative delegation in State Senator Mike Brady, who was or former Ward 2 city councilor before he was state rep and then state senator. And, of course, you have district state representative Michelle Dubois, who served the Ward 6 before representing the folks in the 10th Plymouth District. If folks want to find out more about your campaign, how can they do that?
So I have a Facebook page, Shirley Azak, Shirley Azak for state representative. So there's a Facebook page. They can always call me. My number is 508-451-1632. There's a Shirley Azak website. So just shirleyazak.com. And we'll be out there, but I'm on the City of Brockton's website if anybody has any questions about City Council or, you know, any question at all. The best way to get a hold of me is my to give me a call, which is 508-451-1632. And I'd be more than happy to hear from you and discuss our plans for Brockton.
Counselor, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
You got it. There she is. City Councilor, Ward 7 City Councilor, Shirley Azak, our guest candidate for state representative.
This is Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi, on 95.9 WATD.
The pandemic is over and life is finally returning to normal. It's time to return to McGuigan's Pub in downtown Whitman. Come enjoy Shepherd's Pie, a pint of Guinness, and one of the best pizzas you'll ever have on the South Shore. Play Singo Wednesday nights at McGuigan's or listen to the live entertainment every Friday and Saturday night. For comfort food with an Irish pub atmosphere, go to McGuigan's Pub, 546 Washington Street in Whitman Center. And check out the patio at McGuigan's next door at 552 Washington Street.
Invest your time in listening to CAPE Retirement Radio and learn a smarter approach to investing so you can protect your future. CAPE Retirement Radio, featuring Chris Letond, Thursday nights at 6:15 and Sunday mornings at 10 on 95.9 WATD. Monday Night Talk continues all week long. Go to 95.9WATD.com/Monday Night Talk and keep in touch on Facebook and Twitter. And now, more Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi.
Okay, so we're back for yet another segment. You are tuned into Monday Night Talk here on 95.9 WATD. We like to think that we've been the staple in evening program and conversation for the past, 12, 13, 14 years. And we have this particular show has some great reoccurring guests, some great sponsors. Joining me is somebody who actually falls under both of those umbrellas. And he has been on to serve for different conversations, whether as a premier sponsor of the radio program or to talk about industry. And that is none other than Mr. Richard Rosen, a fine proprietor of McGuigan's Pub and the patio at McGuigan's. But he also is one of the South Shore's best realtors and has one of the best real estate agencies in and around the South Shore. Richard, welcome back to the show, sir.
Good evening, Kevin. How are you?
How are you? How are you in the how are you and the bees doing these days?
Well, I'm getting all the hives ready. The bees will be arriving on April 23rd, and we're going to go at it for another year.
Excellent, excellent. So the reason why I have you on, I every year around this time, I like having a realtor on, and I have kind of a little bit of a round table of folks that I tap into their knowledge and their instinct as to the market and how it's trending. And you're one of those individuals. We talk about, you know, your success as a restaurateur and as an entrepreneur, somebody who has had, you know, who has two restaurants, but you've been highly successful as a developer and somebody who deals in real estate. This time of year, spring market is usually big, especially for those people who are either going to look to sell their home, put it on the market, or are potentially looking to, maybe they feel they have outgrown their space, maybe they don't want to rent anymore, and they may want to kind of delve into buying.
So the spring market historically starts right around now. Runs for a couple of months, slows down during the summer. Like the rest of the world, the real estate market has been upside down lately. It's a tough time for people looking to buy a house. It's a great time for people to be selling the house if they have someplace to go. Historically, Whitman, Hanson, Abington, the areas around here, and generally have 55 to 60 houses on the market at any one time for sale. A month ago, one day I looked in MLS, Multiple Listing Service, and we had one house on the market in Whitman. And that one house doesn't last 24 hours. I happened to look this morning, and to my surprise, we actually had like seven houses on the market, which is a huge jump from just a week ago, which shows me that people are getting ready to sell. Again, as long as they have someplace to go. Problem is that if you have a house to sell, it's all relative because you think you're going to make a ton of money selling your house right now, which you are, but you're going to spend that same amount of money buying something else to move into. If you don't have a place to go and you need to buy something, you're in trouble. If you want to sell your house and move to Florida, perfect. But I do see the market coming back a little bit. You know, interest rates are still really low. They say that they're going to raise the rates 5 or 6 times this year, which still leaves the interest rate relatively low. So that helps buyers buying the house. It helps sellers, again, if they want to move someplace. But I'm kind of encouraged by everything in general that the world is coming back. Life is coming back. Hopefully the real estate market will come back and it's not so overheated. And when there are that many houses coming on the market, it won't be as overheated. So I see that as a good sign.
If I can ask your professional opinion, we know over the past few years, the one common theme to when we talk about housing is that there isn't enough housing stock. What realistically can be done to improve the housing stock here in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts?
That's a really interesting question, Kevin, in this. I'm sure if you talk to 10 people, you'll get 12 different answers. Obviously, as you know, I'm a real estate developer. I have a subdivision going on right now in Carver of 15 lots. It is amazing to me. I'll be sold out of it shortly, and the prices of the houses are crazy. I've developed a whole lot of condos, which most people want to say is bad for the town. They have no idea what they're talking about. A condominium is great for town. It doesn't affect the school system. There are relatively no children in it. There needs to be a lot of housing stock built, whether it be single family houses, whether it be condominiums, apartment buildings. They're just, I mean, and all the charts and graphs and professional opinions say we need tens of thousands of housing units to change the market. But if I do 27 condos, yeah, that 27 people moving in, but what about the other thousands? You know, it's really a difficult situation for someone wanting to get into the market. You know, I did Paradise Gardens in Whitman several years ago. It's 44 units. I sold 44 units. I got my brains beat in at the appeals board hearing because I was going to destroy the school system single-handedly. As it turned out, I think there was 3 school-age children that moved in, and 2 of them were actually continuing their education in the town they moved from. Someone just sold a condo up there. Let me just say, in real estate, you never look back. You cannot look back in real estate because you'll kill yourself. Someone just sold an end unit with a finished basement for $425,000. I think I sold that unit somewhere in the mid to upper 2s. It might have been the upper 2s on that particular unit. So that shows you what's happening. But you need additional housing stock.
Knowing that we keep seeing the price of homes, again, it's supply and demand here. You know, there's always been a fear that, you know, if the prices keep going up and up and up and up and up, that there could be, you know, a balloon, a housing balloon, you know, that could burst and that we could see the prices of housing fall. Is that realistic?
Very much so. And I am, as you know, the biggest optimist in the entire world.
Yes.
I've been doing this for a long time. I've been in the real estate business almost 40 years. I've been through several real estate crashes. It's going to happen again. It happens every 10, 15 years. What's going to prolong it this time, and I'm not an economist, but I believe that what's going to prolong it is those low interest rates, because that's still driving the market. There's a lot of people that have been sitting on the sidelines for a long time. When you see someone going in and buying a house and they're offering $40,000 more than they're asking for it, that person's going to be in trouble in a few years. I don't want to be the doom and gloom guy, but it has to happen. It's not sustainable for what's going on. And every realtor has the same stories. They'll do an open house. 20 people come up to the open house and there'll be offers $5,000, $10,000, $15,000, $20,000. That's not enough. People are offering $30,000 and they waive the home inspection. Some cases they'll waive the appraisal, which the banks don't necessarily care for or sometimes don't allow. You're starting to see some houses that aren't appraising. I think it's going to be a while, but it has to happen at some point.
Again, if you're just attuned in, we're speaking with Richard Rosen. Richard's been on for a couple of different reasons. He's a reoccurring guest as a sponsor of Monday Night Talk for his two fine establishments in downtown Whitman, Washington Street, both McGuigan's Pub and The Patio. But again, he is an award-winning realtor, somebody who's been recognized for economic development and some of the things that he has done in and around the community in the South Shore. And we're talking with him about the spring market when it comes to real estate. So at the beginning of our conversation here, you kind of put it so eloquently that you got to make sure that before you sell your house, you have somewhere that you have to go. Let's say somebody, they're able to find that new landing place. What's the best thing that they can do for a realtor like you before putting it on the market? What's some of the key things they should be thinking of doing to prep that house for sale?
I mean, you know, I'll go into people's houses and they'll say, what should I do before I sell it? A lot of times, just cleaning it up, making it look good, sprucing it up. I always tell people, I come in and I look for holes in the walls and broken windows. Other than that, you're not going to get your money back by putting a ton of money into the house, because you're going to want to paint the house inside because you don't think it looks good. Well, you're not going to get your money back because the person coming in isn't really looking at the color of the paint. They're thinking they're going to paint the house inside anyway. I mean, sprucing it up, making it look good, make sure there's no, you know, literally holes in the wall or broken windows, have it neat and clean. And here's another thing that I always suggest to a seller. Don't call one realtor. Don't just call me or whoever is out there. Get a couple of opinion of values. So if you're a seller, you call, I always say call three different real estate agencies and start by telling them, I want an opinion of value, but I'm not signing anything and I may not put my house on for a little bit. It's a free thing. But what happens is some of these inexperienced realtors are people that really, really badly want listings will overprice your house like crazy so they can get the listing. It used to be that if you overprice a house, they'd come back to you and say, oh, I can't sell it. It's a little bit different nowadays, but I would, because everybody's paying overpriced, I would still get three prices and see where they're coming from, who they are, the realtors, and put your house on the market accordingly. And of course, everybody that's selling the house wants to put the house on as high as they possibly can. In this market, against my better judgment, it's probably the right thing to do.
So you had mentioned earlier that the interest rates are low. Where are they hovering around right now? Are they still around 3-4?
So mid to upper threes, low fours. I mean, you can get commercial loans for 4.25, which is unheard of. So you're looking at the, in the threes, you can get a mortgage, which is great for first-time buyers.
And I will say, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that the interest rates have been historically low for the past, maybe the past 10, 15 years, but there was a time in the early 90s when you had double-digit interest rates, correct?
So I'm gonna age myself.
Uh-oh.
I bought a building when Jimmy Carter was president, and my interest rate was 17.5%.
Oh, my God, that is not peanuts.
I had this, oh, no pun intended, huh?
No pun intended.
I was having this discussion with a guy the other day about when he bought his first house. And, you know, my first house was a lot, the interest rate was lower than when Jimmy Carter was president. So I've seen the rates all over the place. The rates have been reasonably low for the last few years. And they're going to stay that way for the next couple of years.
Do we anticipate them at least climbing up half a percentage or a percentage point at all? Knowing that we're seeing inflation and everything else, the cost of living rising, is that bound to go up as well?
So I think the Fed has already announced. They raised it recently, and I think they announced that they're going to raise it five more times in the next year or so, which still, if they're raising it peanuts, it's still going to be maybe in the fours in a year.
And the other thing I was going to ask you, you had teased the fact that nowadays it's, you know, homes are being snapped up in an instant once they're listed. Is it unheard of in the past 6 months to a year to see a house remain on the market for 30 or 40 days? And if so, is that a warning sign?
It's a warning sign that the house is probably in badly need of repair, and it's been overpriced. Any house that's a decent house that's priced accordingly will not last a couple of days. I've seen a house. It's funny. The house is on the market, and I know the house, and it's really, really a tough house. It's not, there's no one living in it. And I saw the price that they put on, and I'm like, this is insane if someone buys this house. Well, the house is sitting here now like 4 months later because it's that bad and it's that overpriced. So you need to be careful. But nothing that is a decent house that you would live in won't sell quickly.
If is there anything I haven't asked in regards to the spring markets, interest rates, anything like that, but maybe I've overlooked, but you know, that you think that should be mentioned during this conversation?
Kevin, you're as thorough as you always are. I've sat with you many times while you've done interviews, and it always amazes me of the homework that you do before you have a guest on and you have the right questions to ask. So the answer is no.
And then finally, anything you want to tease in regards to if folks want to grab, you know, better weather is coming. So if folks want to venture over to the patio, I'm sure that you're looking forward to the next couple of weeks in April to open those windows, yes, in the patio?
So we open the windows Friday, even though it was a little on the cooler side, and it was crazy. I am really anticipating a really good season. The windows will be open, and you know now the windows open in the pub as well. I'm anticipating that it's going to be, you talk about a spring market, I think our spring market at the restaurant is going to be huge. We're finding that people want to get out. They don't mind spending money. The pandemic, for all intents and purposes, let's pray it's over. People have been cooped up for a long time, and we just started entertainment again every Friday and Saturday night, and both places have been just extremely busy. And our world-famous lobster roll is coming soon.
Can't wait for it. So as we wrap things up with Richard, Richard Rosen has been our guest as a part of a great way to kind of close out the first hour. Richard, if there are folks who have tuned into this segment and may want to tap into some of your agents or call your organization to get maybe a quote or talk with you in regards to putting their home on the market, how can they do that?
Sure. They can call my office at 781-447-1111 or rosenrealty.com. And we'd be more than happy to talk to anybody. I'd be more than happy to talk to anybody. You know how I hate to talk.
Well, again, you're kind of overdue to kind of host the show again. We're still trying to talk you into doing another great segment. You know, or even, you know what? I might even just re-air the Morgan, the interview you did with Morgan White.
Well, or we can just do another show.
Okay.
I'd be more than happy to come down, and I don't think I'll be as petrified as I was the first time.
Good. I'm glad to hear that. Again, we've been speaking with Richard Rosen. That basically is going to close out the first hour of Monday Night Talk. Hour number two is straight ahead. When we come back, we're going to speak with State Representative Josh Cutler. Oddly enough, he's not coming in to talk legislatively,
He's here to talk about his new book. Stay tuned.
This is Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi, on 95.9 WATD.
Each year, about one out of two men and one out of three women will develop cancer. But there's good news. Today's cancer survival odds are much better than 2 or even 3 years ago. Things move that fast. So if you're diagnosed, be sure to have someone in your corner who is on top of all the latest cancer treatments and techniques, the latest research, the newest equipment, all the newest medicines available through clinical trials. And speaking of corners, here's more good news. Advanced Cancer Care is now just around the corner. The Green Cancer Center at Signature Healthcare treats patients locally, with all oncology services and specialties conveniently housed under one roof. The center is affiliated with Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center, so you'll be seen by Harvard Medical Faculty physicians and oncologists. The Green Cancer Center at Signature Healthcare, in affiliation with Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center. Cancer has just met its match. Find out why at mysignaturecare.org/cancercare.
With summer coming, it's time to enjoy al fresco dining at the Patio at McGuigan's. The Patio at McGuigan's serves up dishes like Koji steak tips, 14-ounce pork chops, and chicken masala. Have you heard about the Patio Sampler Platter? It's a dish worth driving to. And you can enjoy live entertainment every Friday and Saturday night at the Patio at McGuigan's. Patio at McGuigan's is at 552 Washington Street in Whitman Center. And check out McGuigan's Pub next door at 546 Washington Street.
Find Monday Night Talk on Facebook and share your opinions. Go to 959WATD.com/Monday Night Talk.
Welcome back to Monday Night Talk. Our number two is ahead. Later this hour, we're going to speak with Mike Joshua. You know, Mike from Americanorama. We've had him on the show before. We're going to chat a little bit about the passing of Foo Fighter drummer Taylor Hawkins, talk a little bit about some of the great musicians we've lost, whether through tragic ends or other means that they may pass away. He'll be joining us. We'll chat with him about that. Joining us for this segment is none other than State Representative Josh Cutler, who is also an author. And we're here to talk today about his new book, The Boston Gentleman's Mob. I almost just gave it a regular name. Maria Chapman and the Abolition Riot of 1835. Now, this is not his first book. This is actually his second. Oh, welcome to the conversation, Josh.
Thank you, Kevin. Great to be back. Thank you.
As I teased, this is your second book. Let's first start off by talking about what is your newest book about, The Boston Gentleman's Mob?
Sure. Well, actually, I think it's actually easier to flip it around because it kind of one leads into the other. But basically, you know, I wrote a book that came out in 2019 about it's called Mobtown Massacre, and it was about Alexander Hansen, who was a newspaper publisher during the War of 1812 in Baltimore, Maryland. And the town of Hanson, here in the South Shore that I have the privilege of representing, was named after Alexander Hansen. And I can recall when I first learned that fact, I thought, huh, that's kind of interesting. Why is that? Because, you know, typically around here, most of the town names, you know, come from either, you know, sort of Mother England or Native American names, if you look around. And so, you know, the fact that this town of Hanson was named after a newspaper publisher from Maryland, of all places, you know, struck a chord. And so I thought, there must be a good story there. And, you know, after a few years of kind of noodling on that, I decided, well, I'm going to find out. I'm going to really look into this. And I did. And, it was really a fascinating story for me, you know, someone who is in public service, but also had a history of being a newspaper editor before that. So Alexander Hansen was this gentleman who was a Federalist. He was very, had fiery opinions. And was very strident in his views, very much against the War of 1812, and used his newspaper at the time to really attack the administration and the folks that were advocating for the war, and you know, in a really tough way, and it earned him a lot of critics, and especially in the city of Baltimore, which at the time was dominated by what is known as the Democratic Republican Party versus the Federalists. Those were the two political parties at the time.
And so Hansen became very unpopular, and a mob attacked his printing press and attacked him on two occasions. And on this subsequent occasion, he was almost killed. In fact, he was tortured very brutally by this mob. Another gentleman, one of his supporters, was actually killed. And so it became, it was a brutal incident, really, that happened the War of 1812, right as the War of 1812 was beginning. And so Alexander Hansen survived that incident, and he went on and decided to run for Congress. And then later he served in the United States Senate. And in fact, he was one of the youngest U.S. senators in history at the time. And he was, at one time he was compared to a young Daniel Webster, and he was, had a bright future ahead of him as this young Federalist firebrand senator. And sadly, his career and his life kind of took a turn for the worse. He never really fully recovered physically from the attack when he was defending the newspaper. And his own views, he was so strident, so, dogmatic in his views that he really had trouble adjusting, I think, to Washington, D.C. And sort of the give and take that's sometimes required for serving in those kinds of positions. So he died at a young age in 1819 and never really sort of fulfilled his promise. But his stand in defense of the freedom of the press and freedom of speech during the War of 1812, really resonated across the country, especially here in New England, which at the time was very much a Federalist hotbed, much like, I guess in some ways like we are today. New England, sort of has a different political viewpoint than some of the southern states. And I think that was certainly the case then. And Maryland was more of a border state. So it was what we might call a swing state in today's parlance. But Hansen's courage really resonated with folks in Massachusetts, including some of the people that served with him, including Daniel Webster. And so when he passed away, when he died shortly thereafter, just by coincidence, the town of Hansen, which formerly was part of the town of Pembroke, split off, and the residents in Hansen wanted their own town. They wanted their own township because they felt it was too far to travel to go to town meeting. And so they petitioned the legislature to form their own town, and the legislature approved that, and that happened in 1820, and sort of just by confluence of all these events, the legislature and some of the leading Federalists decided to name the town after Alexander Hansen in his honor for the stand that he took in defense of the freedom of the press as a Federalist icon. So that's a fairly lengthy explanation, but it's a fascinating story of how this came to be. And so I wrote a book about that in 2019 and really enjoyed that process of going through, the writing, the researching part. And, I had to travel to Baltimore, and they have some great historical society resources there that were really helpful to my research. And then obviously, researching the Boston, the local angle. And so anyway, had a lot of fun doing that. It was well received, and we donated all the proceeds to local historical societies. And then when the pandemic came on, and as a local state rep, I'm used to going out every night to the different events and community events and such. And so when that wasn't really possible, when everything flipped to Zooms, I decided, I really like to take on another project. And so this sort of became my COVID project was to write another book. And, I was always interested in this idea of, the whole aspects of the mob and how that intersected with freedom of the press issues and politics. And so it led me to the subject matter for the book that I've just written a book about, which you mentioned, the Boston Gentleman's Mob. And the subtitle is Mariah Chapman and the Boston Abolitionist Riot of 1835. And really, Kevin, this was about a unique event that happened here in Boston. This time, the scene was right here in the city of Boston in 1835, as sort of the dawn of the abolitionist movement, the early stages of the abolitionist movement. And Mariah Chapman was a young woman from Weymouth. So again, we have a South Shore connection. And she and a number of other women and some men really took a stand against I took a stand in support of abolition against against the expansion of slavery and for the immediate emancipation of all enslaved persons. And there was a mob that attacked her and a number of other folks in Boston in the fall of 1835. And so, again, I took a hard look, deep dive into that particular incident and what happened that day and the ramifications that had on the abolitionist movement in Massachusetts and really how it resonated across the country. So that was sort of that was a long precursor to how I ended up writing this book.
Yeah. Is this a story that's well known and that's been told before? And also, the way you told the story through multiple sets of eyes and through the key participants in the story.
Yeah. So, this is an event that happened. It happened October 21st, 1835. And I don't think it's super well known. I wasn't really aware of it. Maybe other folks were more knowledgeable about these things at the time. It's not super well known. And what's unusual about it, a couple things, is number one, we always think of Massachusetts as sort of being a hotbed of the abolitionist movement and being very progressive on these issues. And, you know, that may have been the case later on. But at the time, and this is 1835, at the time, that was not the case. And much of Boston was hostile to the abolitionist movement. In fact, there was an anti-abolitionist meeting that was held at Faneuil Hall in the summer of 1835 that was attended by, you know, more than 1,000 people and many of the leading residents of the city at that time. So it was a very different time. And the other thing that's really interesting about this particular incident, I thought, is that the people the men, it was mostly men, who came out and were, you know, on the streets demonstrating were really from the upper classes of Boston for the most part. It was, you know, the businessmen, the bankers, the statesmen, the insurance folks, militia members who were out on the streets, up in arms about this abolitionist movement. So typically when we think of mob violence or mobs, it's, you know, sometimes the lower rung of the economic ladder, but this is really the opposite. And so that was intriguing to me as well. And what I chose to do, Kevin, is, the focus point of a lot of this anger was on a gentleman named William Lloyd Garrison, who is probably a familiar name to a lot of folks listening out there. He was a newspaper publisher, published the Liberator newspaper, which was published in Boston for many, many years, which was sort of the leading voice for abolitionists and against slavery. And William Lloyd Garrison, you know, is a pretty well-known figure. And so what I chose to do is try to sort of highlight the roles of some lesser-known figures. And I ended up focusing on four individuals that played a key role in this mob attack on various sides, one of them being Mariah Chapman, who was a young woman from Weymouth who went on to have a really remarkable career. She really, became more prominent because of her role in this mob attack. Also, a young woman named Susan Paul, who's an African American woman who came from a fairly prominent African American family in Boston at the time. Her dad had helped to found the African Methodist Church, which is still there. It's now a museum up on Beacon Hill. And so she was a member of this women's group that was fighting for abolition, and some other individuals that played a role. So it was kind of fun to kind of look at some of the characters who are lesser well known, but I think, you know, and would argue that deserved to be more known because they really played a prominent role in this, you know, pivotal historical event. So it was a lot of fun kind of peeling back the layers and getting details and trying to learn about some of these individuals who played such a big role in this event.
If you're just tuning in, we are speaking with Josh Cutler, talking with him about his book, The Boston Gentleman's Mob, Mariah Chapman and the Abolition Riot of 1835. And he's giving us the key details here. I have to say, do you feel that it was important to share and show the courage that people had, especially when a crime is committed and community leaders just kind of fail to step in?
Yeah, so that was another interesting aspect of this, Kevin, is that, you know, the mayor at the time was Mayor Lyman, And he, you know, he was a very popular figure in the city. He was a very benevolent person, and he donated a lot of money to charity. He done a lot of good things. He helped to help bring fresh water to the city, which was a big deal at the time. And, you know, but he was very ambivalent, or some might say even hostile, to the abolitionists. Again, you know, many folks in the city, many of the leading residents in the city, you know, they for the most part, you know, they did not support slavery, the enslavement of individuals, but they also were hostile to the abolitionists because they were, you know, some of them felt that the immediate abolishment of slavery could lead to civil war and would upset some of their mercantile relations with southern states. That was a big factor. Many of the leading industries relied on cotton cultivated with the labor of enslaved persons from the South. And so there was a lot of vested interests in the city at the time in perpetuating this, even if many expressed their opposition to the practice. And Mayor Lyman, you know, really, I think, represented sort of the city side, the establishment side in this, although he, again, was someone that had spoken out against the practice of slavery and as a younger man had written about it. But he was sort of put in the role. I mean, I guess he becomes the bad guy in a sense, and that he was unable to stand up to the mob. He was unable to protect the women that were and men that were there that day. And so I think in his role is he did not shine on that day, I shall say. He did a lot of other things subsequent to that in a benevolent way. But on that particular day, I think he fell short.
What was it like to research this book compared to Mobtown Massacre? Was it a similar process?
Yeah. So the nice thing, Kevin, well, number one, this book, you know, everything takes place here in Boston and Massachusetts. So that made a little bit easier for me, especially during a pandemic, because, you know, for the first book, I had to travel down to Baltimore a few times to go in person to the libraries and such. But one of the great things, I guess, this is a good plug for our libraries, because one of the, you know, during COVID, a lot of things were closed, but, you know, the Boston Public Library has a fantastic website called Digital Commonwealth that has a ton of resources that are digitized. So thousands of letters from this era still exist. Obviously, people wrote lots of letters in those days. We don't do that today, but they wrote letters, you know, all the time. And so many, many of those letters have been preserved, thankfully, thanks to our public libraries and other historical societies. And so I was able to really do a lot of digging online through Digital Commonwealth and, you know, reading hundreds and hundreds of letters from participants in the day's events. Some of them are, you know, I have terrible handwriting myself, and some of them had some tricky handwriting to read. But once you are able to discern that, they really do open up and tell the story in a way that you really wouldn't be able to tell without those firsthand accounts. So it was a lot easier. It was harder with COVID, with things being closed, but it was a lot easier because of the great resources that we have, you know, from our libraries and our historical societies. I spent some time at the Abington Historical Society. They have some great resources that were helpful to my research. Obviously, I went to the Weymouth Public Library because Mariah Chapman, you know, was from there, and they have some of her, they have a nice bust of her and her husband. So it was, it's a good plug for libraries. You know, they play such a crucial role in many ways, but it's certainly, you know, for historical research, are really, really invaluable to my work.
These two books are listed in the true crime genre. And that was just somewhat becoming a favorite category for you to pen books in.
Yeah, so that part of it, I don't have any control over that. So the publisher handles that. I would not put it in true crime. I mean, and they, you know, they are true and they were crime, but it's not true crime in the sense that, you know, I think of. It's more of a historical, you know, narrative. But yeah, it's you know, one of the things I've learned is sort of the art of publishing and how it works. And you know, it's not an easy thing to navigate, certainly for myself. You know, I consider myself an amateur. But again, I do this, you know, I donate all the money back. I just do this because I enjoy the ability to kind of dive into this and enjoy telling these stories that I think are, you know, are kind of neat stories that deserve to be told. And so that's how I approach things. I could never be an author for, you know, as a vocation. I think that would be really challenging.
But here's the thing here. If I could just step in for half a second, for someone who you've written two books, your first book won the 2020 Baltimore History Prize, as they called it a gripping account of how a Federalist editor risked his life to defend his anti-war views. I mean, you're getting accolades for, you know, your research and your storytelling. That has to at least motivate you maybe to write more.
Yeah, no, for sure. No, I was very pleased and honored by that. It is, when you work on something for a long time, it's really rewarding to see that, you know, people appreciate it and enjoy it. And it is nice to hear feedback from folks. I've done a number of, you know, sort of author talks. I did a bunch the first time, and then unfortunately we ran into COVID. And so a couple of them had to be postponed. And now I'm getting back to doing that as we're able to do that. And we've had some author talks around the South Shore, doing one in Whitman soon. And we'll be doing some in Boston as well. And that's been fun to kind of talk to folks and share the story, but also, have conversations with people about this. And I do appreciate the feedback. And I try to take the approach as a former journalist myself of approaching history and to make it a very readable and engaging way. We don't need any more dry history with just lots of dates and stuff. I think we want to, you know, bring it alive. And that's what I try to do. And in my research, I really try hard to find the small little details that kind of bring the story alive, like what it might have smelled like, or what the weather was like that day, or, you know, things like that can kind of bring the reader right into the action. And so I try to do that. Sometimes it's easier when there's more of an historical record. Sometimes it's more challenging. You have to really dig deep, but that's what I shoot for. And I'm glad that people generally think that, that I've succeeded. So.
And if you're just tuning in to this segment, we are speaking with Josh Cutler, State Representative Josh Cutler, who is also an author. We're talking about his new book, The Boston Gentleman's Mob, Mariah Chapman and the Abolition Riot of 1835. We've even been throwing in about his first book from 2019, A Mobtown Massacre, and talking about that. You talk a little bit about getting feedback. What have you heard from folks? Have you seen anything? I know I was kind of doing a little bit of research, and some of the things that I came across was your newest book has been described as enjoyable and compelling, and well researched. How do you process that?
Well, that's great. I mean, I when you're writing history, you know, obviously the research is paramount, and getting it right is paramount. I try really hard to make sure, you know, that I'm, you know, triple checking everything. And so, that is pleasing to my ears to hear that, because I did, you know, I did really work hard to try to make sure that I'm accurate portraying everything. And sometimes, you know, in the historical record, it leaves you wanting more. And so you have to really dig and find different ways to get information. It's been great. I appreciate all the feedback people have or criticism too. Funny little quick story, Kevin. I remember when I was doing the first book, I had a gentleman from Maryland who was very upset with me, who felt that the book title Mobtown Massacre, that it wasn't a massacre because only one person had been killed, and that I shouldn't be using the term massacre. And he was very persistent that was incorrect. And I thought that given what had happened, that it was appropriate. But not everyone always agrees. And that's the beauty of things. We can agree, you know, we can have these kind of fun discussions. So but I'm appreciative of all that and look forward to kind of doing some more author talks as we're now able to kind of get out and about more. And I'm not sure what the next book project will be. I'm still working on this, getting the word out about the Boston Gentleman's Mob, but, you know, perhaps there'll be a third one in the future.
I'm sure that you had all kinds of emotions when you held your first book in your hand, because again, that's something that you crafted. It's like a sculptor. And when they finally put the final, you know, finishing touches on it, and they stand back and look at it and go, wow, or like a, what was it like to get your second book and hold it in your hand? Was it as, was it as fulfilling as the first time?
It is pretty cool. Yeah. Because, you know, you see as the process is, you know, you submit the manuscript, and then it goes through a review process and copy editing in various steps. And then you get like what's called a galley, typically, where you see sort of the semi-final result where, you know, it looks the way it would look in the book with the pictures and the cut lines and the captions and everything. And you have one final chance to kind of review it and, you know, catch little, you know, little small things. Yep. And then that's it. And then you have no ability to make it. So, but anyway, so you see that, so you kind of have a sense of what it's going to look like, because obviously the publisher, you know, they make decisions about, you know, the cover art and, you know, where the images are going to be. And, you know, I try to suggest things, but I don't, you know, that's their sort of purview. But yeah, it is kind of cool. It's pretty cool when you get the book in your hands and can see it. I know, you know, these days a lot of people read things on ebook readers and such, but it's still pretty cool, I think, to have the book in your hand and, you know, I have a bunch of copies on my desk and to have that. So it's something I always, you know, will appreciate.
Well, what do you hear from your colleagues or your constituents? Have you had some of your colleagues at the State House grab a copy and give you any feedback?
Yeah. You know, it's funny on the first book, Kevin, Mob Town Massacre. So we had, I had an author talk scheduled at the State House Library. And, you know, a lot of my colleagues were going to come. And in fact, the Speaker of the House at that time was going to come and I was all excited. It was going to be great. And that was in March of 2020. So, you know what happened.
Yes.
In fact, I think it was one of the first events that was canceled at that time. And so, so I wasn't able to do that and hoping to be able to get back. But since then, obviously, I've written the second book. but yeah, no, I've been sharing with some of my colleagues and it's fun to kind of talk about it. And some of my colleagues, you know, represent City of Boston, you know, or areas where, you know, that are in the book, which is kind of cool as well. So appreciate and, you know, fun to colleagues on both sides of the aisle. So it's nice to have some kind of bipartisan conversation about it.
Anything I haven't asked you in regards to the new book, but you feel you want to at least share with the folks who are enjoying the segment?
Yeah, no, just I'm happy to, you know, I really love, I've done a number of visits to local historical societies and councils on aging and so forth. And I'm always delighted to do that. If there are folks out there that, you know, want to put something together like that, I think it's a fun way to kind of do a small event and share, and, you know, happy to bring copies of the book and it's a good way for some of our local historical societies to raise a little money for themselves too. So happy to do that. I have a website, Josh S. Cutler, as in my author website.com, where we have some info on the book and just upcoming events and such. So love to do that kind of stuff. I want to thank you for giving me a chance to share, talk about something, you know, non-political, or at least political in the 19th century for a bit. It's a nice little change up.
And folks can get it anywhere that books are sold or strictly Amazon?
Yeah. No, it's at Barnes & Noble in Hingham and in Braintree. And then there's a couple local bookstores. And then obviously, you know, Amazon and Barnes & Noble, the websites available online as well. And Arcadia Publishing is the company that actually published the book. It's called The History Press is their imprint, but it's Arcadia Publishing, so they have their own website as well.
Arcadia does a lot of history.
They do, yeah.
A lot of history pressings, right?
Yep, absolutely. They do.
Well, yeah. We want to thank you so much for your time and continued success on the trail of doing the author talks and meeting folks who've read your book.
Great. Thank you very much, Kevin. I appreciate the time.
Okay, we're going to take ourselves a brief break, but when we come back, more Monday Night Talk. We sit down with Mike Josh in just a few moments. You're tuned in to Monday Night Talk here at 95.9 WATD.
This is Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi, on 95.9 WATD.
That truck, it pays?
What?
The bumper sticker on that truck says it pays.
Pays? Pays what?
I can't quite read it. Oh, it pays to stay way back.
Ah, what was that?
The truck! Snap back or rock! Now I've got a broken windshield.
I'm Peter Brown of Tiny and Sons Auto Glass in Pembroke. It pays to stay way back. However, if your windshield is broken, just call 1-888-64-TINIES. And thank you.
Hi, my name is Alex Bazantin, and I'm running for Plymouth County Commissioner. I am the former chairman of the Abington Conservation Commission, former Abington Water Commissioner, and now serving in my second term as Abington Selectman. I am currently serving on the executive board of the Plymouth County Advisory Board. If you would like to learn more about my candidacy, please visit my website at alexbezanson.org or follow me on Facebook. I am Alex Bezanson for Plymouth County Commissioner, and I approve this message.
Welcome back to Monday Night Talk. Don't just listen, say something. Call 781-837-4900. We now return to Kevin Tachi and Monday Night Talk.
Okay, so we are about to embark on our final segment of the evening. And what a fantastic way to punctuate our radio program with a good friend, a radio personality, actually a gentleman who wears many hats. We've actually had, he and I, this guest, have had conversations about musicians in the past. But we've also talked about his radio show, Americanorama, that has been on these airwaves and has now moved on to bigger and better spaces. Speaking of the one and only Mike Joshua, who is my guest. Mike, thank you very much for joining us.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me, Kevin.
I thought it was essential to speak with someone of your stature in regards to the passing of Taylor Hawkins. And folks are going, who the hell is that? Not everybody's going to know who Taylor Hawkins is, unless you're somebody who loves music, rock music, likes bands like the Foo Fighters. But it seems as though I learned about this a week ago. Friday, I happened to be out of town having some fun, and a friend of mine's like, oh, you're not going to believe this, but Taylor Hawkins is dead. Now, the Foo Fighters were actually scheduled to be part of Boston Calling, and I was already scheming as to how I can get backstage and have an interview with Dave and maybe Taylor. How did you take this news?
It was shocking in... I think my wife and I were on the couch. I think we were catching up on our Mrs. Maisel binge watching. And between shows, you know, I just grabbed my phone, looked at the phone, and my Facebook was just blowing up with, you know, with that news. And I was like, oh, you know, it's just kind of it just comes out of nowhere as these things do. So it's kind of a shock. And I'm a Foo Fighters fan, but my wife is a super Foo Fighters fan. So I just, you know, I tapped her and I just held the phone up and she literally gasped. And I think that's the, you know, it just kind of hits you like, and that happened. Like, wow. But I got to, you know, was I completely shocked? No, but I mean, it's shocking. But when you kind of sit with it, you're like, well, it's not completely shocking, I guess, in the rock and roll world that this happens really all the time when you think about it.
The thing, let's kind of tick down the list of individuals who have suddenly passed away. The first name that comes to mind to me is a Prince. Prince was relatively young, a very talented guy, multi-talented, not only as a singer, but a writer and a producer. We can think of even further back, if you want to, I mentioned to you before we embarked on this segment, John Bonham, you know, of Led Zeppelin.
Oh, yeah.
You know, there's other great names. Jimi Hendrix, Janis Joplin. You even threw out names like Buddy Holly, which is, yeah. I mean, he had no control of that plane. You know, it was
a mechanical failure,
big bomber.
Randy Rhoads at the peak of his career. Another accident, stupid accident in a plane, buzzing the tour bus. Whoops. Freddie Mercury, obviously. Joe Strummer, Frank Zappa, Eddie Van Halen, not too long ago. Sure. Stevie Ray Vaughan, another, hey, we got one more seat on the helicopter. Oh, I'll take it. Oof. It could be just like that. Or it could, you know, and Stevie Ray Vaughan, there's someone who struggled with drugs and alcohol for a long time, got clean, felt great, was on the comeback, and then that happens. So. Michael Hutchins, In Excess. It's just, you could just go on and on, you know, in the hip hop world, Tupac and Biggie, and it just goes on and on.
When we talk about your time at FNX,
Do you ever have a chance to either cross paths with the band or at least go and check out a concert?
With the Foo Fighters?
Yes.
Yeah, so I actually saw the first Foo Fighters tour back before Taylor Hawkins when William Goldsmith was the drummer. So they were a four-piece. They played at Avalon. A band called Hovercraft opened up that show, which happened to be Eddie Vedder's little side project. So these guys were out there just doing this little tour. They played Avalon in Boston. We were there. And actually, the funny part was I was working at Axis at the time, DJing. And Axis on Lansdowne Street was the backstage for Avalon, because the way Avalon was built, there was really not much of a backstage. So the two clubs connected. So they would always use upstairs at Axis as the backstage for Avalon. So Foo Fighters played, you know, they ended their set. We knew there was going to be an encore, but I really had to go to the bathroom like a lot of people did, but I didn't want to wait in the line. So I knew I could run to the side of the stage. I knew I could run into Axis because I worked there and security would let me go to the bathroom. So I took the opportunity. I'm like, I'll be back to my friends. And I'm like, I'm going to run to Axis. It worked like a charm. They're like, of course, go ahead. So I ran up to the upstairs bathroom. And as I ran in, who was on the ground, like changing either his sweaty shirt or his sneakers or whatever it was. But Dave Grohl literally sitting on the floor of the bathroom just by himself. And I ran in. I was like, oh, hey, like, great show. He's like, thanks, man. And I did my thing and he finished changing. And he's like, I gotta go. I'm like, awesome. Like, you know, see you later. Like, you know, it was just the strangest little thing. And he went to do the encore and I washed my hands and went back out. And that's literally, that's the only time I saw the Foo Fighters, was that very first tour. And like I said, my wife is a huge fan. She's seen them multiple times. But sometimes for me, the bigger the band gets, the bigger the venue. I know, just something about those big venues. I like the smaller or Orpheum size being kind of the
cozy.
Yeah, I like that
thing. I don't like it. The big stadium thing. I mean, I saw the Foo Fighters in 2018, and they were. I've seen many a band. I've gone to like the River Raves. I've gone to the big, concerts where there's multiple bands playing, and yeah, you, here and there I've picked and choose who I would see. But I saw the Foo Fighters, and they were phenomenal. Normally, like you, I like the smaller settings. It's just right. There's a coziness to it and a warmth to the sound.
Yeah, and I don't want to. I find myself looking at the big screens.
Yeah.
And I don't know, you're not connecting with the music as much. It's more of a visual. And then I'm like, well, if I'm just going to look at the screen, I could have just stayed home and fired up YouTube videos and, you know, cranked it up and sat on my couch. And so I don't know. Maybe that's just a music snob thing. But after seeing so many shows, I would much rather see us, you know, smaller, more intimate venue stuff, even though I am going to see Paul McCartney at Fenway, but that's, I don't know. I have to check that off the list.
That's royalty right there. Kind of.
Yeah. Literally. Yeah. Yeah. I gotta go to that one. But other times people are like, hey, let's go to the Gillette Stadium. I'm like, no, even though I will go to Great Woods / Xfinity once during the summer, just to kind of, you know, pregame in the parking lot. It's outside and it's, you know, I'll do that like once, but I wouldn't do it again. I want to be a little closer, a little more intimate. I want to hear the sound and not just, you know, have some muddy sound mix from, you know, sitting in the back or the mid areas and being like, this sounds terrible.
You want a quality memory of when you go see an act like that. Funny you mentioned the Xfinity Center or the other 15 names that it's been called over the years since it was created and used as a stage. And, you know, I've had an opportunity to see shows there, whether it was up on the crappy lawn or
right.
Having decent seats down front or in the pit. And yeah, the experience is everything.
Yeah.
I want to throw this out there. You know, Hawkins, it's right now, it's the early reports are that he might have had a series of drugs in his system. I don't know how they've already released this so early. I would think that
toxicology reports would take at least a couple of weeks to a month. Have you heard the same reports? And what are your thoughts?
I mean, I haven't seen a lot. I tend to not dig real deep on this stuff. I like just wait, like, you know, whatever it is, it happened. He's not coming back. So I don't speculate. But again, when I wasn't surprised, I know he had, you know, drug issues in the past. Now that doesn't mean that that's what this was necessarily, but you do have to kind of pause and say, well, I don't think you're a bad person for thinking that, you know, right off the bat, just because of the past. But, yeah, I guess we got to see what the reports say, but you know, it's awful. It's sudden. And it happens on tour, right? This is what happens a lot. Like Chris Cornell, which really hit home. He's out on tour. Taylor Hawkins, he's out on tour. Tom Petty is out on tour. Like, I guess there has to be some thoughts of like, at what point, how important are these gigs? If someone's, you know, this machine, once the machine starts rolling, and I get it with the Foo Fighters, you're the biggest rock band in the world. The machine start, you know, shoves off the dock and you're going, and it's millions of dollars and it's thousands of jobs, and you know, nobody wants to stop the train once it's rolling. But, and maybe nobody knew, maybe there was no signs, maybe it was just out of nowhere. But I look at the Tom Petty thing of like, you know, he was on, you know, taking drugs because of hip pain, and he had to get through these shows. And to me, I'm like, where's the management to say, Tom, you don't have to do shows. We can take you off the road, take 2 years, fix your hip, get off this pain meds, and then we'll come back. But it's something about this train pulls away, and it's like they just can't stop.
Why is it that drugs are synonymous with musicians and some deaths that we've experienced throughout history?
I think it's like an invincibility thing. You know, you survive in a world where you can get away with a lot of that stuff. Like, for people who have, you know, regular job, if you're a plumber, a roofer, a teacher, you know, even if you're partying on Friday and Saturday night, you still got to get your act together to make work on Monday. You got to be a parent. You got to be a spouse. So you might have, you know, a day or two here where you, you know, maybe make some bad decisions, but it just seems like in the rock and roll biz, you're almost expected to be that party person. And I'm sure there's not a lot of people saying no. And everybody you run into probably wants to buy you a drink, smoke a joint with you, turn you on to some drugs, or it just has to be, you're just not living in reality. And I'm sure it's very hard to say no. And you got to have a real strong, you know, a strong constitution to say no to this stuff. And I think that's, and a lot of the people, you know, the 27-year-old club, the Janices, the Cobains, the, you know, they're young people. And, you know, I mean, when I was 27, I was not making correct decisions, even remotely. So I think it's a lot of those things, you know, coming together, unfortunately.
Tuning in, we are privileged to be speaking with Mike Joshua, who wears so many hats, a host of Americanorama. Musician himself, Britannica, or I think you're also doing a Blondie tribute band as well.
Yep, we had a Pretenders tribute called Britannica. We were playing in Kootenai Center for the Arts in on the Cape, coming up in April, playing a Hey Blondie tribute band. So it's fun, and you know, I always think this when I, you know, see like the Taylor Hawkins tragedy or whatever. I think, you know, I wanted to be that rock star guy. I did. That's what I wanted. And then things like this happen and I go, you know, maybe I'm okay. Maybe I didn't need that. And maybe if I was in that position, I wouldn't have even lasted to 50 years old.
Glad you mentioned that. It's got to be a relief knowing what we have endured over the past couple of years with the pandemic, being able to get out and be a part of a crowd. Not to deviate from our main topic here, but you being the musician,
you and the missus, and you got a great group of folks that you work with and you perform with, it's got to be like a sigh of relief that you're finally able to be in front of people and perform and do what you love.
Yeah. I mean, even getting together the practice for a while was like, well, should we have, you know, 5 or 6 people in a little room, you know, sweating and breathing heavy and, you know, so then you're not even practicing and these are your friends and it's your musical outlet and, you know, you're just kind of waiting. So yeah, now that you can get out and play, it's awesome. And now it seems like there's just so many shows and so many things to choose from. It's kind of tough and it's hard to get a lot of people at your shows because there's 6 other shows the same night you're playing and you're kind of vying for the same crowd. So, but I'm not complaining. It's good to be back.
Let's go back to talking about to Dave Grohl. This is a gentleman who he's been in 2 Hall of Fame, Rock and Roll Hall of Fame bands, Nirvana, and now the Foo Fighters. Second situation where he's lost a bandmate.
Right.
How, you know, and both were great friends. Do you think that this particular, you know, we saw what happened with Nirvana when Kurt Cobain passed. Can the Foo Fighters, you know, continue on?
I think Dave's that type A kind of ADD personality that's going to have to keep going and doing something. But I would expect or hope that he takes some time off. Again, I think there's tremendous pressures on these people, whether it's through management or, you know, whatever it is, just to keep the money train going. But I would hope he would just kind of step back. I mean, if there's anyone that could take 2 years off and just doesn't mean he's not writing music and doing that stuff, because you know he could make an album just by himself, but just to not parade out. I mean, obviously he can get any super great drummer in the world that he wants and they would line up, myself included. I'll do it. But yeah, I don't know. I hope he takes a little time off. I mean, I look at like ZZ Top. We lost Dusty Hill, bass player. Just I think it was just this past year, right, as well. But then I see ZZ Top tour dates coming up, and I'm like, Jesus, can't you just wait a little while? Or again, hey, it's their band, it's their thing, they can do what they want. But it just seems like, I mean, that's ZZ Top. I think you've stuck a couple dollars in the bank. You don't have to worry. You don't have to do that gig to pay the rent. Like, just sit back for a little bit and don't. I don't know. That's just me.
Now, this is where I'm going to tap into your musicianship and being a drummer. Think of, first off, you're looking for a drummer. Is it going to be a tough endeavor? First off, half the people that may consider maybe, I don't know, Dave Grohl is considered a really great drummer, probably one of the top 10 drummers of the era. People might argue and say there are others, but, you know, could it be intimidating for someone who might be considering going, oh, I don't know. I mean,
oh God. Yeah. Yeah. That's why I think you need someone that's used to playing in front of that many people, even though not too many bands get to play headline stadiums, but you need somebody who's played around a lot and wouldn't be intimidated with that. I don't think you can just throw, you know, but well, then again, he could throw a curveball and get who's his friend, the girl, the teenage girl from the UK that he did all those.
Have her play.
I could see something like that because she's probably young enough to not even grasp how heavy it is to, like, she would probably just show up, be like, this is awesome. Where, you know, I would be like, oh my God, like, you know, because your mind can wander back there on the.
and let's not forget, I mean, Taylor wasn't just a drummer as well. This was a guy who he did backing vocals, and there were many times during shows. If anybody saw the Lollapalooza in Argentina, he actually did a Queen song, Someone to Love. And it was, this thing was epic, you know, for the one of the final performances that will remember, and the love back and forth between Dave and Taylor. was so surreal. You know what I mean? Where they're like, God, you're the greatest drummer. No, you're the greatest drummer. And, you know, they have appreciation.
Yeah. And I think that obviously goes away. You're not going to bring someone in and have that same rapport. It's going to be more like, you know, there's the new drummer. But and whenever you'd see Dave, if he was on Howard Stern or Taylor was always there, he was always like, you know, Foo number two, you know, Dave's sidekick. I think that you're going to see that change. I think you're just going to see Dave, you know, by himself at this point. So, I mean, it'll be interesting, but he doesn't have to do, you know, Dave Grohl doesn't owe anybody anything. He doesn't have to do anything. He doesn't have to ever make another Foo Fighters record. He doesn't have to answer to anybody. He's got the body of work. He could just get on a sailboat and say, see you later. But I think he'll come back and do something, at least a tribute album, or maybe, I mean, I always thought, you know, why not? Don't replace him with one person, but go on tour with four different people, you know, and be like for the first, you know, play five songs with four different people, you know, and do it that way.
And do like a Doobie Brother thing where you got like two drummers.
Two drummers.
That's kind of sick. I kind of like that.
You know, instead of having all the pressure, be like, first of all, we're going to play with, you know, whoever. And then they tip their hat, they leave. And then, you know, the thing revolves. See, I'm producing. And the thing revolves and there's a new drum kit. And then there's a new thing. And then while they're playing, they swap out the other drum kit. This is good.
Helping drummers.
If it happens,
the problem.
If it happens, remember this. I called it.
Well, let's hope, as you said, you use the ZZ Top as an example. It's, I think there's should be some time between, I mean, they've already canceled all of their tour dates. They realize that they need to mourn his passing and kind of get through this time before they continue to even, you know, look for a future as a band.
Right. I just thought of something too. Popped into my head. Oh, Def Leppard. If you think back, they're at like their peak, their drummer loses his arm and the band doesn't say, well, let's get another drummer, boys. They say, no, he's our drummer. And they take years in putting together one of the biggest rock albums ever, Hysteria. He had to learn how to play his left hand snare parts with his left foot. And they sat back and said, we'll wait. And I think looking back, that was amazing. I don't think that would happen now. I think now they'd be like, well, we got a gig in 2 days. So who's filling in?
It definitely bears watching. And again, if you're tuned in, we're speaking with the great Mike Joshua, who is our guest. And we're actually going to be segueing from one hat to get his take as not only a musician, but also a radio personality, to talking with the producer of probably one of the best true crime podcasts, Saints, Sinners, Serial Killers. This is all produced under the Mudhouse Media brand, and Mike is the producer for this particular show. A big event coming up on April 20th, and I want to give you a couple of moments to kind of plug this fantastic event, starring the two gentlemen whose voices you capture, Dave Wedge and Casey Sherman, the best-selling authors.
Give us absolutely the details. Yeah, so I started doing podcast producing and editing during COVID for MudhouseMedia.com, a Boston startup company, and it's been really great. We have so many talented people involved in the project and with the podcast, and Saints, Sinners, and Serial Killers is one of the podcasts that I produce, and Casey and Dave bring their stories from their journalism careers and their books that they've written to real life, and it's really cool because there's a lot of true crime podcasts out there, but these guys are literally talking about the stories they covered. So, you know, when Casey Sherman says, I went to go to talk to the killer, you know, these are things they really did. When Dave Wedge, you know, talks about the, you know, the Boston Marathon bombing, of when he got to the scene, like, you know, they're not just researching and bringing stories back to life. They're talking about stories that they, you know, they had boots on the ground for. So it's a great podcast. And now we're going live, Wilbur Theater, as Kevin said, 420, April 20th, Wilbur Theater will be some live podcasting, excuse me. And I'm part of that show as well. So it's going to be great.
Now, my understanding is that there are going to be other folks who are going to be part. It's not just going to be Dave and Casey, but there are going to be other people who are going to be part of this that are already being handpicked.
Yep. We have some actors and actresses that will be coming out to kind of bring some of these parts of these stories to life. So that's really cool. And, you know, music and sound effects and it's just going to be, really cool and different as well to make these, you know, podcasts jump out of just something you hear, but something that you are immersed in as well.
Anything else in closing as we get ready to wrap up the fantastic segment?
Just if you listen to Americanorama on WATD, I'm still out there on uncertain.fm. If you track them down, it's another Boston startup internet radio station. So Americanorama is part of that. And just thank you for, you know, the opportunity. These things, I don't know, rock and roll and death, it's just some kind of morality check, right? When this happens for all of us, It's just something. It's something about when we lose these people, it makes us think, well, gee, if these superheroes can pass away, that means we're all mortal. So that, I think that's where it hits us.
A heck of a way to heck of a sentiment for us to say goodbye for the evening. Mike, I want to thank you so much for joining us and sharing your wisdom and your thoughts.
Absolutely. Anytime, Kevin.
You got it, Ed. I want to thank you out there in the radio land for tuning in to Monday Night Talks so religiously for over 10 years. Until next week at 6:15 p.m., have yourself a great night.